Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon. And guess what? We are doing a continuation podcast from one we did a few weeks ago about the status of doing public history within Mormonism. And on that one, we had Lindsay Hansen-Park, Brian Whitney, and John Grimes. And we talked about the CES letter, we talked about various ways that history is presented, and why it becomes such a stumbling block for people, and we did a little bit of a framing about it, but it was just the next morning even when this group, we kind of have an online thread going or something like that, we said, oh, we should have done this, we wanted to do this, and so the gang has decided to come back together, and I welcome that. It's such a fun group of people to discuss, and we've added to our ranks this time Emily Grover. So in addition to Lindsay, Brian, and John Grimes, Emily Grover's with us. I'm going to quickly just dispense. Is there anything, Lindsay, Brian, or John, you guys want to say about yourselves by way of introduction? Otherwise, let's just spend a little time with Emily.
So, I'm good. Yeah, I'm good too.
You guys are also famous already. Everyone knows you. But, their backgrounds kind of will emerge and stuff we do. But Emily, welcome to the podcast. We thought of you directly because of a great blog post you wrote at By Common Consent this week about getting your sea legs on, was it the old ship Zion?
That's right.
Using the metaphor from Elder Ballard. And tell us who you are, what you do, and then maybe a little bit about what was behind that post, and that might be a nice little way of segging into some of our discussions today.
Sure. Well, I'm a doctoral candidate studying 18th century British literature and women writers in particular. Right now, I'm teaching full-time in the English department at BYU Idaho, so pretty frequent that I find myself in those peculiar and tricky places where faith and intuition are kind of jammed up against education and reason. So,
right.
Yeah, so that's kind of the background where I'm coming from, and the post that By Common Consent was kind enough to publish for me just sort of talks about what it's like to be on Ship Zion, right, as a member with questions and doubts, and that sometimes the metaphor there was that sometimes you can feel a little seasick trying to work with that cognitive dissonance and figure out what to do when you sort of, I don't know, seem like you don't fit in with everybody else because you don't have that perfect faith, but then you're not completely cynical. You don't want off the boat either.
Right.
So, so that's what it was kind of about, is how do you stay on the ship and steady yourself enough that you don't feel sick all the time, but you still acknowledge all of those same questions that you had before, if that makes sense.
Right. And do you mind sharing right off the bat a little bit about the experience of your daughter's blessing where you I don't know, it was just, you put into real concrete, you know, example of what it is that you're trying to do here. You're wishing you could participate. You're wishing women, you know, should be able to be involved with these things. You long for it. But at the same time, you're still able to recognize the beauty that's there and find some peace, even though you want things to be different at the same time.
Sure, absolutely. And this is something that I felt ever since I was a kid growing up in the church, is kind of feeling uncomfortable with what girls can do, what boys can do in the church. But it wasn't really until the last few years when I discovered, you know, feminist Mormon housewives and different places where people are openly talking about well, their questions and wanting to know more about, for example, Heavenly Mother and what is woman's role in the plan of salvation and things like that, that I felt like I had a voice or that other people shared my voice or something. And so, for example, baby's blessings have been something that people have talked a lot about, and I've found myself agreeing with these writers and people speaking up that it does seem a little bit odd and a little bit painful to not be able to participate in such a special ordinance. Are baby's blessings ordinances?
They're not like in that saving
ordinance.
They're
not really, right?
Yeah, they're not one of those essential for salvation kind of category.
Sure.
But they declare priesthood, and there's certain rules you have to follow. So
right,
definitely rituals.
Absolutely. And if I had an 8-year-old, yeah, I, you know, it could have been a story about baptism, for example. But in any case, there are some questions and some frustrations that I've felt. And so, as my daughter's baby blessing drew near, I started to feel a little bit anxious that maybe I wouldn't be able to appreciate it, or that it would be as painful for me as for others, because it to me personally, it does feel like something that is wrong, something that could change, something that doesn't quite feel right. But I hoped that that wouldn't ruin the experience for me. And so I just sort of wrote about, on the actual day of the blessing, watching my husband go up there with the different men, gather around my daughter, sort of recognize the situation for the really beautiful and touching expression of love for my family and my daughter that it was. I mean, one of the things that I note is that none of these men were trying to exclude me. You know, none of them, you know, they didn't get together beforehand and say, well, let's make sure that Emily feels super left out. You know, let's say some misogynistic comments to her first. You know, I mean, there was no bad intentions about it. They just wanted to pray and bless my daughter, which is really, really beautiful. And so I was able to, so my post sort of talks about that, about being able to appreciate those moments for what they are without having to discard feeling like that's still something that could change, you know. What I thought was interesting, though, is that if anybody noticed, a lot of the comments on that blog post sort of turned into the kind of conversation that I was trying to suggest against in the post. So people kind of battled out, should women have the priesthood? No, yes. I saw some people on Facebook say, well, you know, does she want to get real sweaty on a Saturday and help somebody move into their house? I'm real satisfied in Relief Society, all that kind of thing. And so I thought that was a little ironic.
That's good news, Emily. That means you don't have to wait for the blessing to hear the misogynistic comments. You can hear it on the internet any day.
That's true.
Oh, man. Well, that was a beautiful moment. And you know, I love your F. Scott Fitzgerald quote that you do, the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. And you're basically saying that at the same time, you're able to both appreciate the beauty that was there while not feeling like you're betraying the true longings of your heart.
That's right.
It was a beautiful post. Brian Whitney, you were the one who, you know, said, hey, we really ought to get Emily on. Was there something in particular about her post that you thought would be a good something that we can seg into our conversation today? Just one quick thing, our listeners. We basically talked about what should we call this one. We don't want to really necessarily talk about the state of public history anymore. But I think we just kind of came up with, why is this just so dang hard? Why is this these journeys? Why are these wrestles so present? And Emily, one thing that maybe would be fun about this is you talked about, you know, kind of wanting at one time to have your Mormon experience be like a cruise ship. And now you're much happier, you know, because a cruise ship, you hardly feel the waves. You know, it's so big and it's so luxurious and it's so nice. But you'd much rather be on a smaller boat. You'd rather be on the Beagle or something that goes somewhere and does something important, because a cruise ship just returns you back to where you started.
Yeah, a cruise ship, you just eat a lot of bad food and, yeah, go back to where you started. I think I haven't taken one, but
You definitely do. You return to your home port. Well, I guess not always. You have relocation cruises and things like that. But anyway, Brian, jump in with something from Emily's thoughts there, or just jump right into something you definitely wanted to share today.
Yeah, well, you know, the post really spoke to me personally. So I don't know about a segue, but I'll tell you what it pulled out of me. And it's this, I've been having this ongoing tension lately between realizing that I do enjoy the sacraments of religion and the sacraments of Mormonism, mm-hmm. while still fully recognizing their exclusions and the pain that is caused by those exclusions. So I've been really personally wrestling with how to kind of navigate those waters. And I think that Emily's post spoke to me because it really kind of gives us permission to hold both of those at the same time and mm-hmm. say, and to be able to say that we do find value in this and that we do recognize that these are really painful things for some as well at the same time. So it's almost like this, I don't know, this, it's like this sadness yet sacredness kind of entwined together. And that appeals to me. And so I really, yeah, I thought it was an incredibly well-written post, and it stood out for me, and I just thought that it would really add to this overall conversation with us. So, you know, I guess that's a little bit of a personal journey for me, and I think that'd be good to go into here with this podcast, is some of our personal journeys.
Yeah, that's definitely, we would definitely want to move from theoretical to just, telling stories and recognizing all that's going on that makes it so darn hard. Any, Lindsay or John, either of you with anything thing on Emily's post that you wanted to amplify or anything?
I have something. I have both a segue for you.
Okay.
And I have the answer to all of our problems.
Oh, gall.
Okay, that might be an exaggeration. But actually, so when we're talking about this, the Old Ship Zion, you know, getting your feet on the ground and this sort of, as Brian defined it, this sadness, holding space with sadness and sacredness. I think, you know, this is where we bring in the theoretical as well for me, but I've been thinking a lot about public history and I've come up with three terms that I kind of want to talk about tonight. So history is one of them. Then my second term is heritage. And then my third term is propaganda. And so I've been trying to think of those three terms and how they fit into my story and how I have viewed sort of my own faith crisis, if you will, with these terms, the history, what is heritage, and what is propaganda? What have I produced? What have I consumed? And how have I interacted and engaged with the stories within Mormonism? So I don't know if that makes sense to any of y'all, but I think my pain and my sacredness sort of meet where history and heritage bump up against each other.
Awesome. Now, did you want to give us the answer to all of it yet, or is that coming later?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'd like to hear more, first. Lindsay.
Well, let's do this because I don't want to leave Emily's post fully. So I wasn't quite sure what your comment to her post. I couldn't quite tell the connection there.
Okay.
What were you amplifying in her post?
So yeah, so let me flesh this out a little bit more. So the idea that you can have pain and still appreciate something, I thought that meant having to come to some sort of resolution with like the problematic elements of church history, right? That I have to somehow be okay with some part of it. Because let's be honest, a lot of the history is really difficult. It's really difficult to sort of reconcile with, you know, maybe the stories you were taught as a child, maybe the experiences you've had, and then you hear this historical narrative that sounds completely foreign to the Mormonism that you were, you know, raised on, if you will. And so for me, throwing the word heritage in the mix has really helped me because the word heritage allows me to engage with the history and the stories of Mormonism in a way that allows me to maybe claim the problematic parts like that Emily was talking about in her post and still feel some sort of sense of belonging or endearment towards. Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Good. So you shared a little bit about that too, when you love Utah, and then, you know, all these names and places, you know, you wanted to celebrate them, but then you've learned about the history of them, and it's been hard, and, you know, you kind of talked about sort of recovering the ability to be thankful still for the connection that you have with those, even though all those places and names are now more complex.
Yeah, and that's, you know, doing public history, which is what I've been doing, and which is what I love. You have to sort of engage with all of these things, with history, with heritage, with propaganda, and you have to decide how you are going to consume and produce this history. And I think for me, when I looked at Mormon history as one monolithic thing, this is history, and this is the way to engage it. It was really painful. It was a painful way to engage these hard issues. But when I look at heritage, heritage is art, heritage is culture, heritage is stories. But heritage also allows you to exaggerate and maybe amplify or maybe suppress things within the story to fit a certain narrative.
Families never do that.
Right. Well, and see, I grew up on a very heritage-based, you know, Mormonism. That is the Mormonism that I have engaged with. And so when the history bumps up against that, you feel like you have to choose one or the other. And I think that to Emily's post, it's this idea of learning to be okay with both of them, if you will, like being in a plural marriage with both of these things. They're both important, and they're both problematic, and they're both complex.
It always comes back to plural marriage with you, doesn't it, Lindsay?
Everything. I say I've got like a Godwin's law for like Mormon fundamentalism. It's like I'll bring up Warren Jeffs and then the argument is done. So let's just get that out of the way right now.
Too funny. Love it. Love it. John, any that was a great comments on Emily's stuff. Emily, do you want to talk back? That's great.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to say that Lindsay, your podcast on the year of polygamy actually was definitely one of those things that did make me seasick, right? That, and I was just going to add to yours that I think one of the anxieties that I really felt is that there was this sense that if I went to church and I said something nice about Joseph Smith, you know, if I, or Brigham Young, you know, if I said, oh yeah, this was a really great thing that they did, inside, it somehow felt like I was therefore validating or justifying everything that happened to these women. You know, like you feel complicit by appreciating the good, you know. I don't have an answer for that. I just wanted to say that was one of the things that makes it hard for me.
Yes.
Well, and that's why I'm hoping we can talk a little bit more about consuming history. I mean, I think in the last one, we were talking a little bit about producing history, and that's like a conversation that I have a lot more to say on. But I think in consuming this history, and I guess I'm using history as a really discursive term because, you know, as Emily talks about in her post, she's dealing with like actual restrictions, right? Like, you know, women's ordination and issues like that. But when we're talking about why is this all so hard, I think that we're talking about like sort of this broad struggle with hard questions in Mormonism. Is that right?
Or just why does it take so much out of us to enter into this space of uncertainty after we'd kind of, you know, been on cruise control?
Yeah, so what I'm hoping to talk about tonight is how we consume sort of that information, how we consume our Mormonism, if that makes sense.
Awesome. And we'll give you plenty of chances. John, I want to give you a chance to, if you had any reaction to Emily's post, I have a couple more things I want to amplify, but I want to hit you first.
Yes, I very much enjoyed the post. It's intriguing to me to listen to the various takeaways that different people have. My takeaway, or at least the part that was particularly meaningful to me, was different than what Brian and Lindsay have said. Not that I disagree. I think that those are great points. But the one thing that I particularly enjoyed that jumped out at me and with which I identified was the passage where she talks about or wrote about the fact that just because people on the boat are feeling seasick, that doesn't necessarily mean that the boat is in trouble or the ship, mm-hmm. I suppose. And instead, she said that maybe it's a sign that we are becoming sailors instead of passengers.
That's the one I wanted to go after. That's so awesome.
Yeah, I love that. It is, to me, without a doubt, the thing that has been, I don't like the word empowering, but it's kind of the right word for me, is when I just kind of, stiffened up my back, decided to be stubborn about it and say, you know what? My faith is my faith. And I get to define its contours and I get to determine how I'm going to live, how I'm going to practice. Nobody else gets to dictate that to me. Nobody living or dead gets to tell me how to live my faith. I'm a sailor on the ship. I will do a job on the ship. It's my job and I will take my responsibility for it. And I really like that. I like the idea that I felt what Emily had written was sort of almost a call to say, let's not be passengers any longer. Let us be sailors. Let us be co-participants.
Yeah. There comes that moment, doesn't there, on a journey or, where in some ways you feel like you were thrust upon this journey or you were pushed or something. But then at some point, there has to be that shift within you that says, I'm here. What are the blessings here? What are the benefits that come from this along with the pain? And boy, when you're talking about why is it so hard, there's nothing better about doing hard things than sort of seeing a noble purpose in it.
Yeah, and claiming it for your own. I mean, I think that most people that find themselves seasick get to that point unexpectedly. They certainly did not want it, and they didn't necessarily seek it out. But there they are. So now, what are you going to do about it? And it seems to me that we can either simply be sick, or we can get our sea legs. But that takes something, that takes some doing, some action. And in order to act, I need to feel like I own it. It needs to be my ship. Or my own little, awesome. My own little boat that's attached to the ship, perhaps.
Can I add a caveat to that, Dan?
Oh, sure.
I think the only thing that I would add to that, and I think that's very beautifully expressed, John, I just would say that we also need to be aware that with this ship metaphor, that there are people that don't need to claim the ship as theirs. I mean, I think of that, like, it shows up in several Buddhist texts and folklore of the, the ferry boat and how, it's the ship that carries you across a river and then you get off and you go on a different path. And that is also a very, very valid narrative. So if, the boat isn't your thing and you want to go trek across the mountains, go do that.
Right. So you're embracing, become your own captain of your own soul, become your directing your own thing. It just may not be on the old ship Zion.
Yeah. And I don't think anyone's saying that, but I just know that, like, when you're in pain and you hear something like this, like, become a sailor, which is a beautiful metaphor. But when you hear that and you're in pain and you're having trouble reconciling this, what it sounds like to you sometimes is like you're telling me I have to fall in line again and that I have to accept these things, even though that they don't seem right with me. And that's not, like, I just want to be clear to listeners. I don't think that that's what any of us are saying at all.
Right, or,
I just don't want it.
Emily, yeah. Either.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and maybe I could also clarify a point that goes to something that Lindsay had said earlier about getting to be okay with the history at some point in some manner, which actually I think what Lindsay said in our last podcast is actually maybe a little bit more accurate, which is sometimes you have to learn to be okay with not being okay with something. And it's ultimately, I'm far more interested in finding peace wherever I can find it or wherever anyone can find it. And And so, yes, to what Lindsay said, I don't care what boat you're on. I don't care if you're going across the mountains. But at some point, I actually feel like people do need to find a way to find that peace. And it's a peace that happens within a struggle. And so, yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't know.
There is. Now there's, you know, and again, this is where probably John DeLynn and I, you know, at one point, you know, he would push me that this is an unfair thing. There's a couple of kinds of peace. There's the, you know, George Costanza, serenity now, you know, in other words, I want the world to stop. I want peace. I'm not going to have anything. And I want this bubble around me of nothing. And that's so understandable. And we need to honor that as, you know, a true and, you know, a healthy step at some points. But what you just said there, John, was that at some point it has to be a positive piece. It has to be a piece that's going somewhere at the same time in order for it to, I don't know, where to be long lasting or to be most fulfilling. What would be some of the ways you extend that? Or did I misrepresent what you were saying?
No, I think that the human animal is destined for conflict. Always. I think our lot in life is conflict. And I think it is through conflict that we obtain salvation. And I don't mean that in a specifically LDS sense. I mean that in a very broad sense. It's Faust, Goethe's Faust. Faust does terrible things, but he's redeemed in the end because he never stops trying. He never stops striving. And it is I would suggest that the only way that we can continue to strive, which I believe is our lot, is to find a certain peace within the context of that struggle. And to me, the concept of picking up your cross is that. It is finding your cross and being willing to carry it, and you need to have some sort of peace within yourself if you're going to be able to do that. That's just, you know, my take on life.
Can I add to that, Dan?
Oh, please.
I like what John's saying, and I think that I guess the way that I'm internalizing that is one of the things that sort of bothered me about not the idea of ponderizing, which the word aside, like I actually really appreciate that idea, you know, of focusing on a scripture and thinking about it and memorizing it. But what really bothered me was the application that I saw so many people read it as scriptures should inspire and elevate always. When for me, there's a lot of scriptures that are unsettling and worrisome and terrifying. And what has brought me peace is being able to admit that. It's the same thing with polygamy, that growing up, I've always been bothered by polygamy. I come from a heritage of polygamy, and I've always tried to figure out how to be okay with it. And I remember being in the MTC and thinking, I've got to come to grips with polygamy if I'm going to go be a missionary and tell people to give up everything for this church. And I remember my branch president's wife coming and telling me, you know, the typical things of, it feels wrong to us now because we're mortal, we don't understand, but if we make it to the celestial kingdom, all of those, you know, all of those mortal, terrible, carnal desires like jealousy and things will all be washed away. None of those icky feelings will remain. We'll just be super happy to be in this really big family, so to speak. And it never felt right, and it never felt peaceful until I was able to be in a conversation where I could say, no, this does hurt, or no, a lot of this is wrong, a lot of this is painful. And that's where I've been able to find peace, is to admit what the struggle and what the crisis is. I don't know if that is kind of where John was going, but that's how it's felt for me.
That's precisely where I was going.
Can I add something too?
Please.
As you were talking, I was getting this image in my mind. I mean, there's nothing really that's more awe-striking than standing out on a clear night and just looking up at the sky, right? And seeing just the magnificent stars when they're really clear, and just these images that we get sometimes from like the Hubble telescope or anything that's of the cosmos, sometimes it can be really moving. But at the same time, we also learn that what we're looking at is the result of billions of years of chaos and entropy.
Yes.
So there's just this balance. And I think it goes along with kind of what John was saying of this beauty that arrives from this mayhem, this chaos. And that's not to say, well, then it's okay to have all this mayhem and chaos. I don't think that we should just allow it either in our personal lives, because I think it can be destructive. But at the same time, there does seem to be this evolving process that can lead to some form of beauty.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. Now, Emily, there was a couple of, John hit the one about becoming a sailor. I thought that was that's such an important framing for us to do. With Lindsay's caveat in mind about it may not be the old ship Zion, I do like two other things that you say. Number one is the whole point of sea legs is that they let you stand on something unsure and moving. So that was the metaphor of your thing. Finding my sea legs on this particular ship for me, but yet the whole point is you're no longer thinking that it's even possible to ever be on something sure and unmovable again. And so you're embracing sea legs. The other thing that I really liked is, and I think it's the most thing that will maybe be concentrating on today. It's like, I think many members are trying to hold on and will find their legs miraculously strengthened beneath them just by being listened to and understood, by having their questions and concerns validated. And that's what I hope this podcast will be about, that, you know, no one would ever feel like any of us are not validating whatever it is that's going on that is, quote unquote, making all this so hard. So, thanks for your post. Is there anything else you want to react to? Anything we've said about it, Emily?
I guess the only other thing I'd say, and by the way, I feel real uncomfortable that you guys have been saying such nice things about it, because that's makes me feel weird. But there was a piece of criticism that I read about the post that I thought was noteworthy, where I read someone say that she found it more beneficial to steady the ship than to rock the ship, which she read my post as doing, because I do talk about change and pushing things. And so I've been thinking a lot about that. And one of the points that I wanted to emphasize tonight is just that idea of, you know, all I'm really trying to say is that to have sea legs, you should be able to appreciate the good while acknowledging what you see as bad, which could be seen as rocking the ship for sure. But what I wanted to kind of add to that too is that bad and good are relative terms. And so what I see as good is not going to be everybody else's good. And so I think one of the things, like what you just said, Dan, about people being able to be heard and validated, is that I think what I would like on the ship, since I've decided to stay on the ship, is there needs to be space for disagreement on what is bad and what is good. And that's one of the things that I noticed in the comments. As soon as somebody came on to say, well, this is why women shouldn't be in blessing circles, that person was immediately, not exactly treated like an internet troll, but kind of like sort of treated by like as someone who doesn't quite see the full picture. And I felt validated by the responses because it's people agreeing with me, you know, so I want to, you know, say that's right. You know, I am right. and kind of fall into that. But I think what I think is going to be important, since we're all going to be looking at church history and current church practices and everything else from different lenses, is that I need to be okay with people that disagree with me, in the hopes that they will in turn listen to what I have to say, you know? And I'm not quite sure how to, you know, how to apply that, but anyway.
Hey, Dan, could I just say something to that?
Yes.
That's actually kind of one of my personal little hobby horses, is learning to speak to people that are I guess, you know, more conservative in their approach, not politically speaking, but conservative in their approach to Mormonism. And I am reminded of a gentleman in my ward who is in fact very, very conservative politically speaking. I happen to be rather liberal. And he's, you know, pretty toe the line, pretty orthodox as well, and I am rather heterodox. He said something recently in church. He said this to me. He said, "John, you are almost always wrong. And I love you."
Yeah.
Right? And I just looked at him and I said, "You know what? You are almost always wrong, and I love you too." To me it's kind of that. It's
yes.
It's not letting the difficulties and the differences and the miscommunications and such get in the way of loving one another. And it's really, really hard. But I guess, you know, one of our, I guess, kind of the theme that we wanted to talk about is, why is it so hard? And I would propose that is one of the main reasons why it is really, really hard is, well, do you want me to go on, Dan?
Let's just go ahead.
All right.
Yeah, this is the structure. Was everybody bring something big to, and we'll go around with everybody. So let's just move right into you, John.
Okay. So to me, one of the main difficulties with having struggles with faith crises, faith transition, whatever terminology you want to use, is that it is very difficult to explain it to someone who hasn't had it. It is very difficult for us to truly empathize with each other when we have not had a shared experience. And so what happens, I think, frequently is that a person who loves me, right? Say my wife hears me in anger or in sorrow or in whatever, you know, she hears my struggles and she hears that I'm upset, and she doesn't get it because she's not there, right? She's not having that same struggle. And so there immediately is a barrier between us that is very difficult to overcome, because I can't make her understand, right? I can try to put the things in front of her that cause me grief and in a way hope it causes her grief too. But I can't really make her feel the way I feel. Nor, on the other hand, can I feel the way she feels. I know that during the decade or so that I didn't go to church, that she experienced tons and tons of pain when she went to church and she heard lessons about the priesthood and having, you know, a priesthood holder in the home and what a blessing that is, because she, in effect, didn't have one. And I know that that was a pain to her, and it's a pain I don't understand. And I can't really empathize with it because it's just not a pain of mine. So we have this little problem in that we don't naturally understand one another's position. And what I think happens is there's an exile that happens. In a way, the person undergoing the faith transition, faith crisis, gets kind of pushed away, because as we express ourselves, others around us feel attacked, they feel threatened, and they don't like it, so they push. Simultaneously, we now ourselves feel different, and so we pull back. So on one side we're being pushed away, and the other one we're pulling back. That's a double whammy. And so you have this real sense of exile, and this is really tough, right? This is a problem, because Mormonism is fundamentally, to my way of thinking, all about community building. And being part of this community is a big deal. And it may even, I think you could even argue that it's the best thing Mormonism has to offer, is this sense of community and the building of community. And so when you're pushed out and you pull back, and we're talking about people that love you and that you love, we're talking about family and friends, right? This is a real struggle. And so I think one of the things that I wish I knew better how to do, is to convey the struggle and the pain and the upset and the kind of, well, and the seasickness, right? The lack of feeling stable to someone who isn't there.
And I think is that, the, go ahead. Well, is the no, same thing going to be true if you find peace to explain to those who haven't yet found the peace or haven't found the
yes,
good place?
Yes, exactly. No, that's excellent. That's excellent. I had an online conversation today where it's an issue where I have found a sense of peace, and the person I was talking to hasn't, just frankly hasn't. And it took us some back and forth to kind of center. But what was cool, I thought, is I think that both of us were trying to at least kind of understand one another. And I think we were able to come to rest at a place where we didn't all of a sudden agree and embrace, but could acknowledge the other person and the other person and where they were at. And so I couldn't put myself in that position anymore, because it's just not a position that I'm in anymore. I've moved to a different position, not better, not worse, just different. And that person also couldn't, you know, put themselves where I am, because they're in a different position. And so, yeah, it's a difficulty dealing with people either who are, you know, very orthodox, or when you have people who are, you know, have kind of come to rest, come to a sense of peace, and those who have on that particular issue, perhaps not. And I think we have to allow, gosh, I can identify the problem. Identifying the solution is a little more difficult. Although I think part of the solution is the understanding that the other person isn't where we are, and that's okay too. It kind of reminds me of, there was one of the comments to our last podcast that a person mentioned, she, I think it was a she, doesn't matter, said that she didn't like it that we were fairly, almost glibly saying, you know, yeah, we don't really have that big of an issue with the Book of Mormon, whether it's historical, ahistorical, non-historical, whatever, product of the 19th century or ancient, doesn't matter that much to us. And she said, that's easy for you to say, you're not a Lamanite, right?
Right.
And so for a person who, you know, kind of grew up with the paradigm that individual was, while reading the Book of Mormon, was reading the history of that individual's people. Well, now all of a sudden, the question of historicity of the Book of Mormon is much, much more loaded. Similarly with polygamy, it's more loaded for women than for men. It just is, which isn't to say that men can't be very upset about it or women can't find a peace with it. I'm just saying that the general rule is that it's a much more loaded proposition for women than men. It's tougher. And so part of what I think we need to do is understand that and understand that the person we're talking to is in a different place, and that's okay, and there are reasons for that, and there are legitimate reasons. And so we need to in order to be understood, I think first we have to seek to understand. And that goes for also the Orthodox membership that we're trying to deal with and that we feel like they just don't get us. They probably don't, but do we get them? We probably don't.
We kind of think we do because
we think
we
do
there
because we weren't, yes,
at one time, but we weren't in exactly the same exact spot as them.
Yeah, yes, that's precisely correct. And so it's one of those things where I think, you know, we have to be a little bit charitable in how we deal with everybody.
Yeah.
When we're talking about faith issues, because there's, I mean, all this stuff is so super loaded. It has implications, you know, both here and now and potentially, you know, then and there. And so, and so it's tough. And I think that we all need to, you know, give each other the space to really, you know, to struggle. And it's, you know, it's hard. It you know, when somebody around me is struggling and they're struggling with something I don't struggle with, it requires a real conscious effort for me to not say, well, that's not such a big deal, you know, to kind of try and explain it away.
Right. Well, you've gave us a lot there. I think the kernel that I'm going to ask everybody else to comment on is this issue of we it's almost like you're saying, well, there's good language actually from Ken Wilber when he talks about different stages of development. And I don't want to get into stages so much here, but he says it's almost like people say, well, the world looks different from me, from you to me, et cetera, depending on where we are. You know, it looks different. He basically says, it is actually a different world. You know, you're living in a thought world. You're living in a way of adding up values and norms and all those different kinds of things. It's almost like we do live in independent worlds from each other. And that was kind of helpful for me at one point to say, no wonder I'm having so much trouble with language. You know, I used to have easy discourse with these people because we spoke the same language, because we seemed to be at least a lot more in worlds that were aligned with each other. And now that person cannot see me saying the same things I used to, and it looks like a loss to them. And I'm not saying the same things I used to because I see how inadequate those words are. And, you know, it just becomes this whole crazy thing. And so this inhabiting different worlds, inhabiting different spaces, you've named, again, a huge one about why this is so hard. So I thank you for that. Who wants to jump in with either their own stories or amplifications on what John's doing, what John's proposed here is one of the key reasons?
I can talk about the boat some more.
Okay.
I'm like obsessed with this metaphor now. I can't get out of my head. So thank you, Emily, for that. I just keep thinking about what you said about what Emily said about the criticism of studying the boat. And my knee-jerk reaction to that comment was, well, if the boat is steady, then it's not like a boat. It's like a house.
Oh,
and like,
yeah.
That's not what we're talking about. But that wasn't very sophisticated. So as John was talking, I've been trying to think this through. And I think maybe part of the problem is, when you're super invested in the journey, you're on this boat, sorry to continue this metaphor, sometimes maybe you get confused with what you are on this boat, like if you're a passenger or if you're the water. And I think that I see this in the ex-Mormon community. I see this in the very faithful Mormon community. Sometimes we think that maybe that it's our job somehow to be the waves or to... rock the boat for other people. And instead of like letting people, you know, the boat rocks. That's what boats do. They rock.
It's life. Yeah.
It's life. Yeah. And so instead of just like, letting people gain their sea legs, we might want to nudge them, you know, into different areas because I think we confuse ourselves with, our own journey. You know, when you get so invested in, like, at least for me, the story of Mormonism, you sort of, at least for me, I kind of got lost in it. I lost my own personal identity. And so it was really important to me that, you know, everybody stayed in the boat because the boat became my identity. I thought I was the boat. I thought I was part of the ship. And that's not the case at all. And so what I think that this journey takes from us sometimes, because it's so hard, and I'm talking about all of us engaging with Mormonism, is sometimes a lack of self-awareness, because it gets really easy to get so invested and confused, and to use another metaphor, maybe, you know, Lehi's dream, you know, this is what I kind of think the mists of darkness are, this idea that we are so invested in something, we can get confused on what the end goal is. And I think that that happens all the time. And I feel like I'm just rambling and not making a lot of sense.
No, but those were excellent, excellent comments.
I just want to go back to something that at the very beginning of what you were saying, John, with the friend of yours at church, or I guess friend, who said, I love you.
Yeah, you're be a friend.
Okay, good. Said, you know, you're always wrong, but I love you, and you said it back to him. The first thing that popped in my mind was Eugene England's classic essay, Why the Church is as True as the Gospel. I think that was a real moment there that I think that Gene was striving to convey in his essay. And if anybody hasn't read that, I would highly recommend it. It's another one of those essays that really helped me to frame things perhaps a little bit more in a healthy way than what I had been pursuing. But this idea of this school of love, right? Go ahead.
Okay. I'll keep going. Before you leave Gene England, before you leave Gene England and go into anything else, I'm going to want to say something, but go for it.
Keep going
on school of love. That's part of it.
Yeah. So this idea of the school of love, and I prefer the phrase school of empathy over love. Just, I don't know, maybe it's just my anti-hippie inclinations. So I go for a school of empathy, but this idea of that the whole purpose of this community that we build together is that we can learn to love each other despite our differences, despite our distastes sometimes towards each other. And that's one of the things that, like you said, John, that Mormonism does very well, is it gives you this sense of community, but also, and it's, it, as Gene pointed out in his essay, it's not a chosen community, right? We have these ward boundaries where people are thrown into this mix together, kind of like a family, where you don't necessarily choose to be in that family, but here you are, and you've got these personality conflicts, you've got these issues, you've got people who just rub you the wrong way. And I can say that, you know, there's guys in my ward, in my high priest group, that there's no way we would get along outside of a church context.
Right.
But you learn to put that aside and to focus on your commonalities, even if they're only just a couple of things, and try to resolve some of those issues that to just love each other. And I think that's what you've expressed, John. And I don't know. I think that that's a real big key in making this work.
Awesome. Before we leave the Gene England thing, many people know that I was hired to at least research for biography of Gene England. Whether or not I'll end up writing it down the road, I won't know. But you know, Gene has moments in his essays where he talks about people like you and your friend there, John. You know, who came to this peace despite, you know, still being in great disagreement. And it may have been Jody England Hansen on this podcast, but I know several of the kids, as I interviewed them about their dad, they talked about how hard Gene worked to make that work, that those kinds of reconciliations happen. So for instance, if he felt like he was in conflict with somebody, you know, he wanted to live the gospel, which is go to your brother, go to your sister with whom you have a conflict directly. You know, you don't want to be talking around the back or something like that. So when he decided to do something like that, they would share that, well, guess what? He did his own spiritual work first. They talked about he'll fast for a day or even 2 days or something. And the whole point of his fast were, what is my role in this? What can I own? What is my accountability for the rift between us? To make sure that he had all of that right there and understood his part. And then he would go and find the reconciliations or you know, meet these people in these things where those things would come about. And so I guess what I'm trying to say, and returning a little bit back to Emily's boat, is Emily, in some ways, you know, gaining your sea legs, it's real work. Let's put it that way. It's like, it's not like you're going to get your sea legs by, again, just being a passenger. It's like you have to get sea legs and saying, I'm on this journey, I'm on this boat, and this is, it's going, you know, I want to take some responsibility.
Yeah, and a point of clarification I think I'd like to make too is my post was definitely directed toward people choosing to stay in the church. Lindsay's pointed out super helpfully that is not everybody's path. And that's actually one of the things too that I've been working through is I think it is worthwhile to be able to find your sea legs on this boat, to be able to feel like you are a part of this church, if this is where you want to be. But one of the things that I don't like about the metaphor, that I think the metaphor needs to change, is that the boat can feel very exclusive. I would like, you know, to imagine that the boat is a boat that talks to lots of other boats on the water, you know, and wants to work with the people swimming and the people, you know, we're sending smoke signals to the people on the mountain. Like, I'd love to see some way of, this is what we do on our boat. And this is how we work with people outside of the boat. This is how, you know, because I feel like, one of my takeaways from all of this about, you know, having space for disagreement, being able to listen and empathize with other stories, is that also involves being able to respect other people's journeys and being able to validate and support people, whether they stay on the boat or not. And if people leave the boat, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad boat. We can make it a good boat for those of us that want to stay. And at the same time, if someone leaves the boat, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're a terrible sailor or that we've lost them. I don't think we have to have lost them. I think we can still work with them, you know.
Yeah, honor that they're sailing with another vessel or taking responsibility for their life in that way. So, great. Maybe,
could I comment, Dan?
Yeah, and then I want to have everybody else kind of, before we leave, yeah. You know, your main point
okay,
about why it's
true.
So hard.
Okay.
But go for it.
No, I just I was just reminded what Emily just said reminded me there was I don't remember who gave it. It might have been Jeffrey Holland who gave a talk about missing seats at the table, not wanting there to be missing seats at the table. No, it was in the Ezra Taft Benson manual. Anyhow, so I think it was my sister taught that lesson, and she was talking about missing seats at the table, and she actually took a different direction than I think probably it was originally intended by Brother Benson. And what kind of the word, direction she went was more the idea that whoever you are, wherever you are at, you are always welcome at my table. And I think that's kind of what Emily was just saying, is that people, wherever they are, need to be welcome at my table. And I think that's an important thing.
Awesome. Beautiful. Lindsay, do you want to respond anything to this point of empathy with John that says, man, it's hard because we're not in the same place as everybody and we can't understand each other unless we've been in exactly the same space?
Yeah, and hopefully I'll be more articulate this time because I think that I'm not making my point clearly. One of the things that I've been in this community for a while, and I really have been lucky to interact with such a wide spectrum of individuals whose stories are so different from one another's and whose outcomes are so different. And that is such a gift to me. But in doing so, I've done what, you know, I've witnessed what I call faith politics. And I see this a lot, you know, being at Sunstone, because, you know, it's like every single day, you guys, that I have someone say, oh, Sunstone should be doing more of this. It's too faithful, too critical, too this, too that, right? And it's so interesting for me to watch, because what I've started to notice in this position at Sunstone is, like, when people give that feedback, it's far more about usually their biases than it is about Sunstone's biases. And what I mean by that is, like, you know, we have like a wide variety of program and a wide variety of material, and people seem to pay attention to, you know, wherever they're at in their journey, that's what they latch on to and they see. You know, we had like Ed Smart at our symposium, right? And he's very faithful. His whole panel was people. It was like a Mormon testimony meeting, and it was such a small amount of people. And then yet we have like the Meet the Ex-Mormons thing, and, you know, we run out of room there. And so then Sunstone gets accused of being too negative or whatever. And it's just interesting for me. So I've been paying attention to these faith politics. So we're talking about this idea of like allowing people to get their sea legs. And I just kind of want to put the community on notice, like the listeners on notice, that these faith politics we are all a part of. It's a system that we inherited from Mormonism, which says there are things that are safe and there are things that are not safe. There's good and there is evil. There's God and there's Satan. There's black and there's white. And we kind of, we all sort of put ourselves in camps at different times depending on where we're at. And I'm not exaggerating this. There are people out there in the community who have criticized me for, you know, being like even sitting next to someone who has been excommunicated, right? And I just think, what are we doing in this community? You know, I've been able to watch my friends in the last few years be excommunicated. I mean, people that have helped me in my journey, and some have done it gracefully, some have not done it so gracefully. But even the fact that we like interact and position ourselves, there's this whole political tension that's going on behind the community. So John is talking about this interaction in his ward that's beautiful, which is fantastic. But that is such a rare opportunity in some ways, and then in other ways, those are like, you know, God's grace that we see every day in every interaction. And yet outside of it, it's still this narrative of faithful and not faithful. And so I think that when we're having this discussion, I want us to be super, you know, self-aware and self-reflective of where we fit and how we play into this system of faithful and non-faithful, and how we maybe engage with people in the community that have harmed us or whose opinions we think are so outrageously ludicrous. And what does that mean for us when we engage in these discussions?
Wonderful. Does anyone want to jump in?
Sure. You make me think about myself, and of course you just challenge us to do that, right?
Yes.
So I guess I've always felt like a bit of an outsider. My experience growing up in the church was just so different. I wasn't really raised in the church. Didn't go to seminary, didn't serve a mission, didn't go to any church schools. Really didn't become active in the church until I was a young adult. And so I just didn't have those formative experiences. I had to learn all of this as an adult, and within the first few years of being active, I got called into a bishopric position. So then I really had to learn. Fortunately, I was in an award that was also very unusual and unique. And, you know, it's really difficult for me to, like what we were talking about with John, to put myself in a position, in the same position of somebody who has invested so much into the church, because I always have felt like have stood a little bit on the outside of it. So it's a challenge for me, honestly, to understand exactly where people are coming from and why this is so hard for them. Because I've never really sunken my teeth into it so much. I mean, I've sunken my teeth into the history of the church. And I found it fascinating. I found it challenging. I've seen the pain around me caused by people who have felt their world has crumbled apart. I empathize over that, but I guess it's hard for me to understand exactly like how to speak to them, other than just shutting up and just allowing them to have that, right? And that's something that's even had to develop for me. I still have to second guess it. This morning, I got online on Facebook, and first thing that pops up in my feed is a thread by a few friends of mine, who I consider good friends. They're no longer members of the LDS church. They've moved on and they seem to be in good places, but man, this thread was super negative. And it was just, you know, why is the LDS church do this and why that? And I really had to fight myself to not get on there and start contributing to this conversation, because I just knew that it just wasn't going to end well, and there's just really no point to it. So I just backed off and just cleared my head of it and just allowed them to just do what they needed to do, and I will still have great civil conversations with them outside of that context. We don't need to go there.
Well, you've opened up, and John, even early on, you said, I don't know if there's any solution to this, you know, living in different, you know, head and heart spaces and not being able to empathize with it. Brian, you suggested that maybe one of the possible solutions is just to sit it out, but you also said also to not engage, or no, you said once before, maybe just to hear them and listen might be listen in silence and maybe, you know, with open energy to them or something is almost the gift that you can give. But,
and you know, it's weird. I never really think about anybody as to whether or not they're faithful, or whether or not they're active in the church. I just have the friends that I have. And, you know, I mean, sure, there's some people that go to church more often than others, but I don't have that labeling system put in place for saying, well, then you must be this. If you're on a regular church attender. And I think it's just because I've never been really immersed in that culture to begin with. So, you know, for me, I couldn't tell you in my ward who's really faithful and who's just attending because it's what you do. You go to church on Sunday with your family, versus who really buys into it, or just who buys into it just out of it being a cultural thing that they've never questioned, right? So, I mean, we're all on these different levels and different planes of existence, I guess is kind of what we're talking about tonight. And, you know, who am I to question them as much as who are they to question me? But yet we're all still together, you know, and yeah. Now that I say that, I admit that I do leave after sacrament meeting quite often and walk home, but, you know.
Can't stand on the butcher of the New Testament one more week. Yeah, okay, crazy. Okay, so let me just ask the question again, though. Does anyone have, you know, John proposed a dilemma. Maybe there is no one right way to respond. When we do find ourselves just having to acknowledge that we are in a completely different world or we can't fully understand somebody else, what's the best thing to do? Anyone with ideas on that?
Well, I just want to, you know, Brian is really good at this. So like, I'm not pointing this out against Brian or anything, but like Brian is good to have friends that disagree with him. But I guess what I would say, what if they're not friends? What if they're strangers you encounter on the internet who are hurting and who say really, really offensive stuff about your religion? I mean, let's scale back a little bit from like where we can meet each other, you know, in the gospel, and let's go with a scenario that's really challenging for us. So what do you do when you encounter someone who's saying something that you feel like is really unprocessed, is, you know, just not a full picture of the history? Let's say that they come on and they say, you know, Joseph Smith, I saw this on Reddit the other day. Joseph Smith dressed up like an angel and he was a fraud and he was deceiving everyone. And, you know, there's this account of him across the river dressing up as an angel and they had to like beat him to the ground and unmask him. And of course, Joseph Smith did that because he was just trying to trick us. So you don't know this person that's saying that. You don't agree with what they're saying. You can see the problems in their narrative. If you're a historian, you can doubly see the problems in their narrative. So my solution, and I don't know that if this is a good one, but the starting place that I have learned, and I've had to like practice at this, is to say, okay, when they're saying these things, what are they really saying? Like, are they saying to me, you know, Joseph Smith's an idiot and I need to think Joseph Smith's an idiot? Possibly. But normally what I'm hearing in these conversations, and again, this is probably too broad, but what I'm hearing is I'm hurting. This makes me angry. Like, this information makes me angry. And when someone's in hurting, let's take Mormonism out of the picture now. If someone comes to you and they're hurting, our reaction isn't to be like, well, here's what's wrong with you and here's right. What's wrong with your outlook. Yep. But we do that with Mormonism, right? Because it's so easy. It's so easy to say like, well, here's the problem with your narrative, blah, 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 blah. And so maybe that's the question I throw out to you guys is, what do you do when it's a stranger who says something really dumb and really offensive about your internet, you know, on the internet? Like, how do you engage with that?
How do I engage, or how do I think I should engage?
Nice, John.
Because I will admit that those are two very different things.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And
yeah, go ahead, Lindsay.
Go ahead.
Oh, it's Emily. I was just going to say, on the flip side of what Lindsay's saying too, that the people who respond and say, you know, I don't know, they quote a scripture, they quote a general authority as if this is the end all statement. I feel like in a lot of the ways that faithful church members respond to hurting people like that, it's because they themselves are also hurting, right? That it's, you say that about Joseph Smith, that hurts me and scares me. So I respond with something that's just as painful about why, you know, I don't know, you're going to hell because you left the church or something like that. You know what I mean? And I feel like both polar opposites, both of these binaries are hurting each other, even though they're acting out of their own pain. So we somehow have to see past it on both sides, the faithful perspective and, you know, the post-Mormon or ex-Mormon perspective, if that makes sense.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah, it's like, to go back to your metaphor again, I'm sorry, I keep doing this, but, you know, sometimes people, what they're really saying is, stop rocking my boat. Like, life is hard enough. Like, don't rock my boat for me, you know?
Yeah, totally. And the result is just that nobody hears each other say anything, right?
Yeah. Now, one thing that occurred to me, and it seemed like you were driving us in that direction, Lindsay, is, you know, when I see this, I naturally go to the, they must be in pain. It was about 6 months ago, we had one of our podcasts where I was trying to almost, you know, really push this idea of, once we know that somebody's in pain or once we know they're afraid, if we're in our normal human mode, our natural thing would be to nourish them, to nurture them, to acknowledge the fright or whatever. But it's so hard to kind of sometimes say, well, what I think is going on here, and you offer this diagnosis of it. But how can we in our heart, you know, react to this with, like, this is somebody who's hurting or somebody who's afraid and I want to nurture. So I think that's an important impulse to try to develop, and I won't try to push that any harder. So the more practical question, Lindsay, is when somebody is, you know, doing something that outrageous on their, if it's in a public group, because history isn't my main thing or whatever, I will definitely hold back and not feel like it's my calling to respond to them. But if it were more of a private conversation with somebody who it wasn't the complete stranger with me, I certainly would try to. But I generally like have to say, what's my energy capital right now, what's my time, and am I called to these kinds of discussions? And a lot of times I've decided no, but I hope that I would still always be open to some kind of spiritual prompting says, you know, this is one where it is important for you to act in this, you know, proactive way.
So I think I've kind of come to a point now where I don't feel like I need to correct everybody's history. I think that part of that came from realizing that my own history might not be so good to begin with.
But you get tagged a lot, Brian.
Yeah,
it's time for Brian Whitney to jump in here. So I kind of get that too sometimes. Anybody mentions Fowler, things. Weatherspoon, get in here. You know.
But I think there's also, you know, I can be honest and say, well, I'm, you know, like for this specific situation that Lindsay brought up, if somebody was to bring up this this story that I'm not familiar with, I think I can probably just say I'm not familiar with the story at this point, and not necessarily trying to belittle them or challenge them or say, well, you're just blowing things out of proportion, but just simply say I'm just not familiar with that story and just kind of leave it there. You know, but yeah, I don't think it works to correct. I mean, we hear this right when people are going off for missions, you say it just doesn't work to debate with people about like religion and about like the Bible or anything like that. And I think the same kind of holds true to some extent when it comes to history, because I think Lindsay's right that it's really a cry out for that, to recognize that I'm in pain over the turmoil that I'm experiencing. And it really probably doesn't have much to do with the history at all. Now, if I was at a history conference, it might be different,
right?
You know, where you have a bunch of people who are well-versed in history and they're going to, you know, in the Q&A kind of hash it out a little bit. But on a public board, I think that we do need to recognize that the intent is, what they're looking for is not somebody to come in and say, well, you're an idiot. Mm-hmm. We might all think that, but, you know.
Well, and again, like, I think that the reason why I keep coming back to history is because that's how we originally discussed, like, the concept of this podcast. And, you know, it's something I'm very interested in. But that's where I, you know, the three terms that I brought up at the beginning, history, heritage, and propaganda, in Mormonism, and probably in a lot of things, it's those lines can get really blurry, especially when the stakes are so high, right? You know, because Mormonism depends so much on historical narratives to sort of back up these truth claims that sort of perpetuate these testimony meetings. And that's how some of us grew up building up our gospel on. When those change or shift or, you know, pivot in any sort of way, it's really destabilizing. And that's, you know, where we get this pain from. And I think that we would all do better, and I'm kind of now directing my comments mostly to ex-Mormons, we would do better to really start to untangle for ourselves what is history, what is heritage, and what is propaganda. And that is in producing history, and that is in consuming it. But we're not really taught that, you know, in our religion. And I'm not sure that we're supposed to be taught that. Like the distinctions between what is history, what is true, and what is heritage. I mean, I think about the times I have some fantastic friends in the church's historical department. And I remember when I was just right at the beginning stages of my faith crisis, the really angry stage, finding out these, like, you know, really scandalous facts, I'm talking to one of the historians, and I'll leave his name out just so he doesn't have to admit that he slums it with me. But he was telling, he was saying, oh yeah, well, have you read this? Did you hear about this? Can you believe this happened? And he's just like loading me with more facts. And I'm like, you're not supposed to do that. You're a church historian. You're supposed to like make excuses for this stuff. And I think what I've been learning in this process for myself is the difference between the history, you know, what is the best story of what we can come up with, what we think has happened in the past to shape us, versus what has shaped me. And that's my heritage. That's my story. Those stories can be exaggerated, and those stories can be underscored. And I think that if we all did a little bit more work on that, it would probably mitigate some of the pain, not all of the pain, because it is painful.
I agree. Now, Ty, do a little bit more on propaganda, because that's such a loaded word. How are you using it here? Just do another minute or so on that.
Yeah, so I think when we use propaganda in this sense, I think people think that I'm talking about church propaganda. And certainly there, you know, church propaganda does exist. Any organization that puts out materials that has any sort of public relations runs a risk of propaganda. I mean, sure. That's just how it is. But I think about in the stories that I tell myself and then the stories that I produce, because remember, as I'm talking about this, I'm personalizing this. The goal is for me to be self-reflective. So I'm thinking about the history that I produce, the public history, the stories that I tell. And propaganda to me is when sort of you take history and heritage with maybe, this word is so reductive, but an agenda in mind. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's really easy to consume your heritage or your history in a way that can view it through the lens of propaganda. Or there's plenty of propaganda out there. I've seen a lot of public history that there is, like, you know, a reason they want to be the smoking gun to show you why the church isn't true or whatever. And I just feel like that's the harmful narrative that we inherit from Mormonism, this true or not true. And propaganda is everywhere, and we're not really good at discerning that, you know, with whether it's, you know, church propaganda or ex-Mormon propaganda or anything in between. And I just feel like within my own life, I have to constantly decolonize in my own brain propaganda that I'm creating for myself, you know, narratives that I'm creating for myself. So I don't know if that really makes any sense, but I think that we have to be super thoughtful with all of this stuff.
Yeah. And it's probably impossible to ever shed any kind of agenda. You're just saying make sure that you're alert as possible.
I don't think you can shed an agenda any more than you can shed your personal experiences that shape that agenda. But I do think maybe it becomes propaganda. Maybe you guys can help me, you know, better determine this, but I think it becomes propaganda when you need it to be something and you need it to have a message for a specific reason that it wasn't intended for, right? So we see that I'll use the church as an example. You know, Legacy, the movie Legacy, is to me a heritage-based movie, but you could argue that it's propaganda, right? It's supposed to take a story, sort of twist and manipulate it to have feelings and to build a testimony. Now, that's not how everyone experiences it, but that's certainly a way to consume it. And I don't know. I feel like that we're not in this internet day and age. It's really hard to distinguish between those three things.
Awesome.
So can I jump in?
Please.
And this goes to the point that I was hoping to bring to the discussion tonight. And I think
it's your turn almost. Yeah.
Awesome. I think it's a great segue, Lindsay, to that is the necessity of seeking a wide variety of voices. So I have this theory that I think that if a person was able to really kind of seek out a wide variety of voices on a particular topic, that they would start kind of naturally recognizing where there perhaps is some bias or some propaganda, just based on their own comparatives of these different viewpoints and different perspectives. Now, they might personally lean one way or another, but I think that their awareness of how different people tell stories will help them to understand that it's not so clear-cut and that there are a lot of different ways to look at things.
Yes.
So that's always my top advice to anybody, is just don't stop. Don't take anybody's voice as being the definitive end-all voice on any particular topic that you're interested in or even concerned about. Continue to seek different perspectives, different viewpoints, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to reconcile issues. It doesn't mean that you're going to go find a solution for them. It just means that you're going to recognize that there's different ways to discuss these things. Some things are a little more alarming than others. Some things are a little bit are resolved, and you know, just enjoy that experience of having these different takes.
Yeah. Now, I think most people do end up getting there in their life, but instead of just making this just a here's something that everyone should do, let's acknowledge that that's not easy to do, that takes time to do. Even, you know, stepping outside and trying to inhabit another, you know, religion's worldview, or, you know, somebody within your own religion, to really try to get inside and almost think like them enough to where you can, you know, use those lenses to predict, you know, where they would go on other questions or something. That's hard work. And again, it fits our thing. What makes all this so hard? It's a great thing that you're recommending, Brian, but we definitely need to acknowledge that it's not easy.
No, it's not. But sometimes even a simple thing like subscribing to Dialogue or Sunstone or, you know, a history journal, if history is your thing, even something as simple as that can introduce you to a wide variety of different voices that can kind of help this process along. It doesn't mean that you necessarily have to be reading these 650-page books and doing comparative analysis. It can be articles. It can be something that's small, but just – or even just – the blogger knackle or podcasting or any of these different mediums that people are attracted to. The idea is just to get exposed to different people who think differently about things.
I just wanted to say that also with that, which I 100% agree with Brian, except for I'd say definitely subscribe to Sunstone, obviously. But also hold space to claim your own narrative and your own experience, that just because someone has a really compelling argument that might, you know, bump up against your own experience. If you've had a negative experience with polygamy, you don't have to accept it. If you've had a negative experience with, you know, the historicity of the Book of Mormon, you don't have to claim that. You can consider these good ideas, because what that does, what Brian's point does, is it makes your heart more open. You can consider these ideas, but you don't have to claim them as your own. You know, I think about this last conference that they had at the University of Utah, on race, and I didn't get to see this part because this was a ticketed portion of the event and it was sold out. But Elder Joseph Satadi, am I saying his name correctly?
I don't know.
He's from Africa, and he, you know, I don't know exactly the wording that he was saying, but he basically, I guess the message that was relayed to a lot of people was, you know, African-American LDS saints need to sort of get over this idea of race and the priesthood ban, because in Africa, the saints are over it. They're joining the church in record numbers. And I don't know if that's exactly what he was said, but that was definitely the feeling that a lot of my friends that went, that have been struggling with these issues, were thinking about. And I just think that that's an interesting, you know, contrast when we're talking about this, that he's saying something completely rooted in his experience, which is, you know, an African experience, which kind of, you know, it has colonization, absolutely, but it sheds a lot of American history and the history of American racism. And that's bumping up directly against the experience of a lot of African Americans who have struggled for generations and have generational trauma. And so where does your gospel begin and end against his, you know, gospel? And he's a leader. And that's the sort of stuff I think that we're talking about unpacking here, is making space for his experience when it can feel like it's erasing yours completely, mm-hmm. or at least offending yours.
Wonderful. Emily, yeah. Jump in.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar, although I think Lindsay was a little more eloquent with it. I was just going to say that one of the things that I see people really struggling with as they start delving into church history is they want to find the actual true account. You know, what is, where's the history book that's going to give me the straight facts, the real story? Mm-hmm. And I think that it's so empowering to accept that there is no one real story, but that it's a collection of narratives, that you yourself are, you know, collecting narratives about your own life that you would tell differently to different people in different moods. And so being able to understand that, and accept, I don't know that history is this collection of stories that you can then synthesize, as, you know, as you're taking your own journey. I guess, sorry, this is kind of a roundabout way of, I guess what I'm trying to say is, as I was moving away from kind of the church authorized, LDS.org stories before the essays came out, you know, Rough Stone Rolling, actually, when I read that, I read a lot of parts of different narratives that I hadn't, that hadn't fit into the narratives that I'd read before, and I obsessed over it. I felt like I'd read truth for the first time, and it was very scary, and it's all I could think about. And I feel like I see this, with friends that I've met and with friends that I've known for a while, that you can obsess over where the stories conflict, and they become really toxic. And I feel like sometimes you can get really caught up in these stories that sort of suck the life out of you and take the breath away from you and make you forget all of these other narratives as well. And so one of the things, I hope this is making sense, one of the things that I'm trying to do is be able to take, all of these stories. And I like that Lindsay talks about history, heritage, and propaganda. I think that's a lot more useful than, you know, church sources and anti-Mormon sources, which was the binary that I grew up with, looking at church history. But being able to kind of authorize and validate all kinds of stories from all over the place and accept that it's complicated and messy and that some women, you know, were able to do a lot of things in a polygamous relationship that they wouldn't have been able to do in a monogamous relationship on the East Coast or something, you know, or in London or something like that. I don't know if that's making sense. It's embracing the messiness of it all and understanding that there's no one story that's going to trump all the other stories.
Or facets of every story. Yeah. Terrific.
Just real quick. So people ask me quite often, like, what do you recommend as the definitive biography of, say, Joseph Smith or of Brigham Young? And, you know, and my answer to them is, well, there isn't one, and there really can't ever be one, because it's different historians telling different aspects of that person's past and personality and the things that they believe about them. So, you know, if you really want to have a definitive biography, you kind of need to give all of them a shot and synthesize them together. You need to read Brody, you need to read Vogel, you need to read Bushman, and you probably need to read Donna Hills as well. If you really want to delve into it that deeply, don't let one voice be the dominant one.
Terrific. Hey, you guys, we kind of hit the 90-minute mark, which was what I hope we were doing for the whole thing. So I hope our listeners and everybody has just enjoyed it as much as I have. You guys are just four fascinating, wonderful people. And I think each one of us have brought up and have had sort of time to at least put out one aspect of, you know, these journeys and these topsy-turviness and things like that and why it's so painful. What I'm going to ask each of you to do now is just kind of do more of a 2 or 3 minute max kind of, you know, is there anything left, or is there something you want to reiterate a little bit more as we kind of head towards a close? So, Emily, can I start with you? We kind of started with you earlier.
Absolutely. I guess I'll just end with, I actually have a Lowell Bunyan. He was an LDS educator back in the 40s and 50s. Pretty well respected.
Yes. Can't go wrong with a Lowell quote.
Right. I think so. I have this quotation on my office door, actually, that talks about when faith and reason meet in the life of a college student, he talks about how you have to have a working relationship with faith and with reason. He mentions blinders and that one of the easiest things that a student can do is when they read something that knocks up against their faith and makes them doubt, that you can just flash your blinders against it so you can't see it and keep moving straight ahead. But Bunyan talks about how you can't do that and retain your integrity, that you can't don blinders to reason in order to protect a childlike faith. And the quote ends, to be sincere, to have integrity, faith must be examined and cherished in the context of one's total life experience. Furthermore, a faith that cannot withstand and transcend the light of reason is not a faith worth keeping. And I like that. That's something that I want to pass on to my Mormon students that come into my classes, is that that idea of a working relationship, which is what I wanted to emphasize in that post that I wrote, being able to see what bothers you as well as what inspires you, and to carry both of those ideas in your head is the way to have a testimony with integrity. And I think if all you do is, you know, smell the roses and talk about how wonderful the scriptures are, that every verse in the Old Testament just makes you want to sing, you know?
Yeah.
There's not a lot of growth, and that it can be really painful for people who maybe have a problem with, you know, what Lot does with his daughters and things like that. So that's what I would end with.
Fantastic. Hey, thanks for joining our little gang.
Yeah, it was fun.
We loved having you. You brought a lot to us, so thanks very much. John, can I have you try a little parting words or whatever you'd like to call this, a little wrap-up?
Yes. At the risk of offending Brian, who has professed his distaste for all things hippie, I have kind of a little hippie story.
He said he was a John Whitmer, but he was really a Burning Man. So
exactly.
We know the truth.
You got me.
Yeah. Well, I've seen his beard.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I know what's going on there. As I was thinking about doing this podcast, I took a moment to kind of revisit some of my own anguish, and I can identify why it was hard for me, and it goes to a moment very early in my marriage. I was talking with my wife, and I think I said something to the effect that you're the most important thing in the whole wide world to me. You know, something like you'd say. And she said in response that I was number two. And number one, I don't remember if she said God or if she said it was the church. But I knew that regardless of which of those words she said, she equated them as the same thing. And so when I began to struggle in earnest, I didn't talk to her about it because she didn't love me as much as she loved the church. And that was very, very painful. That lasted until a moment much more recently when she did something that probably enabled me to really kind of transition to a different stage out of the angsty, angry stage, and that probably saved our marriage. When we were sitting at home and she told me that our marriage was more important to her than the church. And she said that she loved me more than she loved the church. And at that moment, I was able to open and to share. And I could do it with less anger, which made it easier for her to, you know, experience it. And so for me, the key is that for those of us who struggle, and for those out there who may love someone in faith crisis, love them, love that individual more than you love the church. And I actually feel very Orthodox Mormon when I say that, because that's how I interpret what I would call the gospel, is loving that individual more than you love the church. I think that if we can actually do that, if we can actually love the individual more, and if they can sense it, I think that's when communication becomes possible. When we can share, you know, share instead of lash out. And so I guess to me, if I were to identify, you know, both the challenge and the perhaps solution to the challenge, it is there. It is, the challenge is not feeling the love, not feeling the acceptance, feeling exiled. And the solution is to very overtly let the individual that we're interacting with, wherever they are, know that the love that we have for the individual is strong and is stronger than the differences, than the struggles, than the disagreements.
Beautiful. So. Choose relationship over dogma, over or anything else. Yeah.
Always, always, always.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, brother. Good to have you on again.
Hey, I loved being here and loved being with all these guys.
Awesome. Lindsay, you've shared history, heritage, propaganda. You did a little bit about faith politics. Was there anything left on your plate?
Yeah, I guess I just want to, I mean, faith politics is a topic of concern for me always because I, you know, I work at Sunstone and that's on the radar all the time. I think back to my own faith crisis, and I remember the work that we're doing in the feminist Mormon community right now is a lot of issues of race and privilege. And when I first started doing that work, it was really difficult for me because as a white woman, you know, I never had to really be challenged in those ways. And I remember sort of having an ugly cry with some of my sisters of color saying, like, listen, I get it. I get that you know, feminist Mormons need to do this work and it's hard, but can't you acknowledge that, like, it's painful for white women to care about polygamy? It's painful. Why can't you acknowledge that? And one of my friends, Jennifer Gonzalez, said this so beautifully to me, so I finally understood it. She said, Lindsay, what you're experiencing is so painful. This, you know, figuring out the church isn't what you thought it was, that is painful. It's like going up a mountain and falling off a cliff, right? You have this mountain that's beautiful and you fall off this cliff and it hurts because now you're down in the valley. And what she said that really rang true, like that just shook me to my core. She said, but Lindsay, people of color in this church have always been in the valley. We've always been down there. We never had that mountain where we fell off because we've always seen the church this way. We've always been here. We've already known that it's flawed because it's telling us that, you know, that we're flawed and we know that we're not flawed. So we're here in this valley and now you're here too. And I don't know if that illustrates my journey because it was like a long process for me to sort of grasp this concept, but it really sort of opened my eyes to something that Fatima Saleh says. She calls theology from the margins. And this idea of like true gospel, true theology, true love can come from the margins, if we're looking at the margins. And I had spent so much time in my life climbing this mountain, I didn't pay attention to the valley, right? To those who had been down there all this time. And I think that if we really are interested in engaging in this work, in sort of lessening the pain of this process and helping those on the boat, we need to spend a lot more time in the margins. We need to be challenged. We need to have, you know, our broken pieces built up back in Christ and then broken again and then built back up again. And I think that that is what I would say when it comes to faith politics, when it comes to history, when it comes to all these things. Spend more time in the margins. Spend time with the misfits. Spend time with the people that challenge you, that you disagree with. Talk to them. Don't just empathize with them, but like spend time with them. Let them be your people for a while. And I've been, like I said, I've been really blessed the journey I've been on to hang out with the misfits. And that's where I'm getting my gospel right now.
Mm, gorgeous. Thank you so much. You're incredible.
Yeah, happy to do it.
Loved having you, always. Brian, any final little thoughts as we head out of here?
So if I was to speak to your listeners directly and just pick out a strongly believing, active member and somebody who's maybe left the church, maybe considers himself an ex-Mormon, maybe is angry over the experiences that they've had. And if we were to sit in a room together, and if I was to be the mediator, I guess what I would try to sum up this conversation we've had here to apply to them is try to develop some empathy with each other, recognize the journeys that both have been on, recognize that there is good and that there is bad in the church. Recognize that listening is more important than fixing. Mm-hmm. Also, give yourself permission to think. Give yourself permission to experience this journey. Richard Turley, when I was working at the church issue department, said something that's always stuck with me. And it can sound a little bit, off-putting, but I really don't think that he intended it the way that some people take it. He said that the problem isn't that people read too much, it's that they read too little. And I know that that sounds kind of like, well, if you just keep reading it, you'll be able to put it all back together. And that's not what I don't think that that's what he was intending. I think he was intending that you know, you can find some peace in your life, regardless of how you end up resolving it. But give yourself permission for that. Don't cut yourself off at the pass because you're afraid of the journey of where it might take. Allow it to happen and allow it to be painful at times. Allow it to be joy-filled at times. Recognize those areas and just stop fighting against the experience as much as you possibly can. I don't know. Maybe fight against it for a while and wrestle through it. And Lindsay's really hammered this one home into me, is you have to allow people to fight and you have to allow people to go through the anguish and you can't resolve that. And here I am trying to resolve it. So,
it was very, very
validation, yeah, validation, validation, yeah. Right, Lindsay. And I guess I'll just end with, I love you all more than I love the church.
Nice. Nice. Appreciate that.
Good stuff. I just want to point out that I have lots of hippie stories about Brian, so don't let him fool you otherwise.
Yep. Pictures coming, Brian, if you don't behave. Good stuff, everyone. Thank you so much. Loved having you guys on. Hey, listeners, I hope that you've enjoyed this very, very much and that you'll engage with us. Please share your story, share angles on why things feel so hard, what is it that you see going on in everyone's lives. Share your own stories of not only difficulties, but if you have advice and if you have framings and stuff like that that weren't really even that we didn't play in those ballparks, we know that there's tons of them out there. So come to the Mormon Matters blog and leave your comments there. There you can also, again, see the world table. I've talked about it a couple of times, and I'll link to a little video about it. But there's a do discussion system that allows you to set up a profile that then can transfer with you whenever this world table commenting system gets bigger. And you can gain an online reputation for being someone that thoughtfully comments. And in some ways, we're hoping this will revolutionize the internet comment kind of thing. We'll have much better signal-to-noise ratio. So I'll let you discover that on your own. While you're at the website, I'd love it, of course, if you'd donate or if you'd buy books through the Mormon Matters Amazon bookshelf. I get a little piece of the action there, but your support is just invaluable. It's so, so important. It's really what I'm doing to make things work at all right now. And if you're so inclined, and now it's getting towards year end, if you'd think of Mormon Matters podcast for your year end donations, that would be fantastic. It is tax deductible here, and anyway, the whole money piece of it is not my favorite thing to talk about, but it's so important. So I shuck and jive and do stuff like that. But anyway, thanks again very, very much for all that you do. You guys, thanks again. This was a wonderful continuation. This is a fun group. We shared. We made things messier. We hopefully, you know, we're always empathetic and just acknowledging and living in that center of, you know, we're in the middle of it. We're in the middle of a fight. We're in the middle of a journey. And I hope that just hearing other people talk about this has been great for listeners. So, everybody, thank you for being on. Really appreciate you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for hosting, Dan.
Hey, it was so fun, Dan. Thanks.
Thanks, Dan. I love you all, and I love everyone that's struggling through this together.
Awesome, friends. Thanks. Let me just close with the traditional cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.